if you wanted to create on purpose a diabolically pathogenic farming system, you could not create, conceive, build a more effective system than factory farming. That's where we are. It's a little bit woo-woo, but I dare to ask the question, can we eat happiness? Or can we eat abuse? And I would suggest, you know, we say you are what you eat. Well, you know, if what we're eating lives a life of stress and abuse and disrespect, does that translate? Is there any translation there into us compared to an animal that's lived a happy, comfortable, respectful life, you know, respecting the pigness of the pig, the chickenness of the chicken? Nobody in any of these institutions is doing research on the benefits of happy pigs. The only question is, can we grow them faster, fatter, bigger, cheaper? That's the only question. Nobody's asking about happiness. And I would suggest that if that became the foundational question of all of our research, maybe we would start growing healthier animals, healthier food, and we would actually have happier, healthier people as a result of figuring out how to grow happier, healthier plants and animals.
Joel Salatin is joining me today, my friends. He is an American farmer, author, lecturer, and libertarian raising livestock on Polyface Farm in Virginia. Extremely excited to get into this conversation. I have known your name for quite a while, and Charles Mayfield brought it up when we did our podcast together talking about his company. And I knew it was time to get some more regenerative farming voices in here. I had Jacob Wolke on a while back. People really liked that episode. So I'm very excited to have you here, Joel. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Ben. It's an honor and a delight to be with you. Yeah.
So I was listening to your other podcast last night going around. I'm actually here in Oaxaca, Mexico right now. So I'm recording from a hostel in this little Mexican village, and you are recording from rural Virginia. So it's going to be a miracle if this works flawlessly, but we're going to take a shot. I was walking around my town last night and listening to your episode. You've done two episodes with Joe Rogan. You started your own podcast to, you know, go really deep. So one of the things I could not actually find, though, interestingly enough, was just a full backstory from you, from where you came from and how you got to this point where you are today, where you're one of the top voices in this very exciting regenerative farming movement. So could we get just a background on where you came from, how you got into this space?
Well, so my grandfather, my dad's dad, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it started out in, like, whatever, 1945, something like that. And so, you know, dad's a little, and so he grew up that way, the biological approach, and dad had a desire to farm. But, you know, Midwesterner, no money, no land, you know, what do you do? And always ready to, you know, go to the new thing. And so he conceived a plan of going to a developing country where land was cheaper and less government too, and you know, farm. And so he went into the Navy in World War II, flew in the Navy, got out, and on the GI Bill went to Indiana University and got his degree in economics, business administration, went to Middlebury in Vermont for a semester in Spanish, hitchhiked from Vermont to Mexico, and spent 6 months in Mexico, came back and sat for the Foreign Civil Service exam that, you know, all like American diplomats and stuff like that have to pass. Passed it the first time, and got on as a bilingual accountant with Texas Oil Company. Eventually it became Texaco, but Texas Oil Company there in the Wildcat oil fields off of Venezuela in like 48 or 47. And anyway, so he's there and he's saving money, got married, and they went down and in 7 years was able to save enough money to buy a 1,000-acre farm in the highlands of Venezuela and began raising chickens. And then they had my older brother, then they had me. And so we're there on the farm, And very quickly, we took the entire local chicken production business away from the other farmers because our chickens were so clean. And that, instead of the other farmers wanting to know how we did it, they accused us of witchcraft and voodooism and all this stuff. And so when there was a junta in 1959 of Pérez Jiménez, 1959 and 60, junta, it gave, what happens when there's lawlessness is that it gives license for scores to be settled that wouldn't be settled otherwise, you know, under more normal circumstances. And so basically, you know, we fled the back doors, the machine guns came in the front door, lost everything, and tried to get protection. You know, dad went to every minute. I was 4 years old. My brother was seven. And dad met with every, you know, the interior minister, secretary of whatever, of the treasury, all the cabinet level, and nobody, you know, could do anything. And so the only thing to do was to leave the country. And so we did. We came back to the U.S., I landed in Philadelphia, Easter Sunday, 1961. And dad really wanted to go back. You know, he died young. He died at 66, which seems really young to me now. But he left his heart and soul. He loved the country. He loved the climate. He loved the people. He loved the culture. Everything about it was really good. And he had these two boys coming on, you know, so he had his labor force coming on, you know, we're ready to take this. And he had great, you know, great customers. I mean, it was really good. And so that's why he didn't go back. As a family, we didn't go back to the Midwest where all of our relatives were. Mom was from Ohio, dad was from Indiana. Instead, we settled here in the Virginia Shenandoah Valley, which was 3 hours away from D.C., so that if things settled in Venezuela in a few hours, dad could be at the Venezuelan embassy, get paper stamped, and be back on the farm in Venezuela. Well, that never happened, but that's why we ended up here. And, of course, we didn't have any money, we lost everything. And so bought the most gullied rock pile in the whole area. And it was very, very cheap. And started over. And I remember dad was 39. I remember when I hit 39, you know, wondering, man, if I lost it all, would I do something different or would I start over again, you know? And so, you know, dad was tenacious and persistent. And we started over. Well, the first question was, well, how do I make a living on this farm? And I remember as a little child, 5 and 6 years old, experts coming, government experts, private experts, consultants, how do we do? And every single one of them, so this is, you know, 1961, 62, every single one of them was plant corn, use chemicals, build silos, borrow more money, run the cows through the forest, those kinds of things. And dad viewed the chemical approach as a drug addiction. You know, you gotta use more toxic stuff, more expensive stuff to get the same hit all the time. And so you're on this treadmill. And so he knew that wasn't the answer, but we started into then a period of experimentation and just to keep food on, you know, to keep shoes on our feet. You know, mom took a job as a school teacher. She was a high school health and phys ed teacher, and dad took a job as an accountant at a local, you know, accounting firm. He was, you know, business and all that. And that the off farm jobs gradually paid the mortgage over the next 10 years. But it was a time of intense experimentation. And we started experimenting. Dad developed a portable electric fencing system. We started moving the animals around. We were reading, you know, Andre Voisin stuff. You know, Alan Savory wasn't around yet, but Andre Voisin was, and started seeing some of that. Portable infrastructure, you know, composting, you know, different things. We got a wood chipper to be able to start composting. And make a long story short, you know, by the time I was in high school, we had a lot of experiments and had some, shall we say, confirmation under our belt that we were headed the right direction. We could see some fertility coming up. We could see, you know, animal health increasing. And so when I was 10 years old, I got my first chickens from Sears and Roebuck and put them in a little cardboard box, you know, with a heat lamp and raised them up. And I started a laying chicken enterprise at 10 years old, had that all through high school. And we had an old curb market This was a precursor to today's farmers markets. It was a Depression era curb market in Stanton. I don't know how many of them there were around the state or the country, but this one in 1930s and 40s was like a local Walmart. I mean, it was the place to be on Saturday mornings. And, you know, during the Depression, farmers had food and no money, and people in the city needed food. You know, in 1946, Ben, the average morsel of food in the U.S. in 1946 only traveled on average 40 miles from farm to plate. Average. Today is 1,500 miles. Okay, so you know, you had these. There was a very localized kind of system, and so. The curb market was established by the time I came in, you know, whatever, 1972, you know, I'm like 14, and Dad, being an accountant, realized as a small farm, we had to get retail dollar. We couldn't compete in the commodity business because the margins were too slim. We had to start wearing the middleman hats, you know, the processor, the distributor, the marketer. We needed to get more of that retail dollar if we were going to make it. And so so I joined the curb market at about 14, and it was very, very small at that. One did baked goods, and one was kind of a glorified homestead. They cured some pork, and she did vegetables and some baked items as well. And then I came with all the animal meats, the, you know, beef and pork and chicken and eggs. And then I had a garden as well, you know, during those years. And so during, you know, from about 14 to 18 through high school, I was up every Saturday morning at 4 o'clock. It was a year-round market every single week of the year down there. The market opened at 6 o'clock, closed at about, you know, 10:30 or 11, and sold our stuff. And it was, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. Those two old ladies, you know, obviously they were old enough to be my grandmothers, but they took me under wing. They showed me how to talk to customers, how to display stuff, how to deal with happy people and unhappy people, you know, all those wonderful marketing things. And, you know, I was just a teen, and I to this day, I think I probably elongated their time there. Cause as soon as I closed it down and went to college, nobody else in the family was, you know, had the savvy to take over the vendor stand. Shortly after I went to college, the two ladies quit, and then the curb market was no more. But the thing to understand about the curb market was there was a memorandum of understanding between the health department and the extension service that if a vendor was receiving extension service bulletins, you know, so for me, I had to join 4-H. For them, it was being in the Extension Homemakers Club. Then we were exempt from all the government regulations on food. So we could, you know, we could butcher beef in the backyard and sell round steaks and ground beef, you know, there without inspection. We milked a couple Guernsey cows. You know, I could sell butter, cottage cheese. I could sell everything but raw milk without any inspection whatsoever. And so I grew up as a teen under this wonderful inspection exemption. Nobody ever got sick. You know, nobody, but I appreciated the, you know, what that kind of freedom offered for competition in the marketplace. And so I go to college, and now I'm thinking, you know, and I love the farm. I have an older brother, younger sister. They left as soon as they could leave, but I wanted to be here. I wanted to stay here. And so now I'm doing the dad thing, you know, the same thing Dad said, how do I make a living on this little farm? And so I conceived of a plan that I could milk 10 cows and sell the milk, you know, to neighbors. The only problem was it was illegal. Raw milk was illegal. And I've never really gotten over that. So I went to college, and I gradually formed, this is Watergate, you know, and I gradually formulated a plan. Oh, I know I could write a, I can go be a journalist. I had a flair for writing, And I knew that. So I can go be a journalist and find my deep throat and write a bestseller, you know, bring the next president down. They're all corrupt, you know. And so, you know, I'll do that. And then I'll retire to the farm. You know, that was the idea. And so I actually worked part time in high school at the local newspaper. They liked me. And they said, as soon as you get out of college, we'll bring you on staff. And so that was a neat, you know, entree. So I graduated, went down, sure enough, you know, went right on to newspaper staff and became an investigative reporter. And I'm living at home and I'm still, how do I get back to this farm full time, you know? And so Teresa and I married and, we're living in the attic of the farmhouse. We remodeled the attic. I'm sure that was illegal without a permit, but we did it anyway. Remodeled the attic of the farmhouse, instead of the attic, we called it our penthouse. And we began living out of the garden. We had firewood. We had our own heat. We didn't have a mortgage. We didn't have a rent. We drove a $50 car. We lived on $300 a month. And even though neither one of us had high paying jobs, we were able to save half of our paychecks. So in 2 years, we saved up enough that we could live for a year. And so September 24, 1982, I walked out of that newspaper office, jumped off the cliff and came home full time, because we had enough to live on for a year. I didn't think we'd make it, but we did. And living cheaply and frugally and all that, we made it and leveraged the experiments that Dad had instigated during the 60s and 70s. We were able to leverage those. It took us about 3 years to exhale, you know, I think we're going to make it. You know, it took us 3 years, but at 3 years, we realized, yes, we were going to make it. And then it just gradually continued to increase, you know, with the beef, the pastured livestock. And today, the farm generates about 22 full-time salaries. It's a big deal to us. Might not be a big deal for others, but it's a big deal to us. And, we've just been very, very blessed, to see this trajectory.
Thank you so much for sharing all that. That's fantastic. I really like that. And you mentioned how Venezuela is a part of that early story. It's so unfortunate how that country just continues to be an example of what we have to not let happen for, you know, for where we are. I have spent some time in South America. I lived in Colombia for quite a bit the last couple of years and met quite a few Venezuelan people who just told stories about what's happening. And I do a lot of content about Bitcoin here and we learn about like inflation and economics and why money printing always ends badly. And that is unfortunately the country we always point to and say, see, this is what happens. You know, if you aren't careful and you just let the government run amok with a money printer. And so many people are just feeling safe in the fact that we are from the USA and just think that this couldn't happen to us. But I'm sure that just like your industry, like we all need to really be thinking like, you know, we have a few extra ways to kick the can than places like Venezuela, but we are all heading in the same direction if we don't make really aggressive change right now. And I think that's very similar to what you're doing. You know, we need to make aggressive change in how our food is produced and processed and distributed. And I think this is probably a good transition here. We are no strangers on the show to ranting on the woes of government intervention and regulation and inspectors and permits and all these different things that we're told are there to keep us safe and protect us. But listening and reading your work has really highlighted for me how the food production and food industry in general is the most important place to have a true free market without all of that centralized power intervening. So could you give me just a little bit of an overview of where the food industry is at right now? And it's crazy listening to your story. All the way back in the 60s, they're already pushing chemicals onto these food producers. That's further back than I would have expected, but this is a deep issue. And I think I remember hearing you saying on one of your past interviews that you collect books and resources on agriculture, but you don't touch anything after the 50s or something, was it something like that? Because they just started going haywire after that and just started, just going off the wrong direction. So, sorry, kind of a lot of questions at once here. I guess could we just get there's so much to talk about. What's your general overview of where we are right now in terms of the food system? And maybe we can then start looking into what the biggest problems are, how we can start going on and solving those problems.
Yeah, well, probably. Thank you for all that. Probably the quickest way to say where we are in our food system is to realize that the U.S. leads the world. We're number one. Now, there are things you want to be number one. I mean, we just had the Olympics. Well, you want to have the best basketball team, right? Goodness, Simone Biles. I mean, you got to love her, right? Yeah, she's an American, So there are things you want to be number one in, but you don't want to be number one in the world in chronic non-infectious disease morbidity. That's not where you want to be number one, but we are. I mean, think of all the other countries in the world. Think of the backwaters. Think of the poorest country in, Africa, Southeast Asia, whatever, and we lead the world in chronic non-infectious morbidity disease, heart disease, obesity, diabetes, cancer, all those things, which were relatively unheard of in 1900. I mean, the number one cause of death among women was during childbirth. Number two cause of death among women, if you take out the childbirth, the number one cause of death among women was burns. These great big hoop skirts, and they were, and they'd flush around and catch them in the fire. Next thing, there goes mama up in flames, And so it was burns. They didn't have good burn units, and everybody was cooking on a hearth and an open fire. So, so that was the mortality of that day. Men, the biggest mortality was cuts, axes, axe handles injury was the number one thing. And so here we are at this stage, and the other, of course, was infectious disease, typhus and smallpox and things like that. Today, we're into this, we're into this time now where actually our life expectancy is actually dropping for the first time in history. And we have a new lexicon. I mean, you're not that old, Ben, but I'm old enough to remember when nobody even heard the terms Campylobacter, Listeria, E. coli, Salmonella, food allergy. That phrase was not invented until about, 20 years ago. When I was a kid, if you wanted to have a birthday party for a bunch of 3-year-olds, you just had a birthday party. Today, all the moms have to spend a week communicating with each other of, well, what's your kid allergic to? What can we have? What can we not have? And so what I'm suggesting is that this new lexicon is essentially nature begging us as stewards, please, enough, stop, stop abusing me, stop, disrespecting me. And this is nature's balance sheet, if you will. We say nature bats last. And so perhaps the reason we live, we the U.S. leads the world, not only in non-infectious chronic morbidity, but also we lead the world in health expense. Nobody even comes close to the per capita expenditure that we do on healthcare in this country, not even close. And, is it a stretch to think, well, maybe we lead the world in these things because we invented McDonald's, because we invented concentrated animal feeding operations, because we invented, we didn't invent vegetable oils. but we invented Crisco. We you know, vegetable oils were invented in Germany as for diesel fuel and lubrication, and we decided to make food out of them, and basically invented the hydrogenated vegetable oil, you know, craze, margarine and all those things, as opposed to butter. We invented DDT. We've invented genetically modified organisms. When you go down the path of what we have created as a country, culture, you realize, oh, you connect the dots. Well, maybe because we did all these things over here, it's creating all these things over here. And so our food system right now, our food system is completely dominated by a mechanical philosophy toward life. Food is fundamentally life. It is fundamentally biological. It is not mechanical. And so a tomato is far more complex. The soil is far more complex than just the anatomy of an automobile, or even the anatomy, the guts of a computer, as complex as that is. Our bodies, Ben, are, we've got, MIT says we're only 15% human. We're 85% non-human. 85% of us is microbes, things that actually aren't human. And so we have some a quadrillion relationships and decisions being made per second by beings. I mean, when I was in high school, I remember, looking at cells, and we thought, we knew the cells had pieces in them, the nucleus and things, but that was about as small as we got. Now we know that a cell has up to 1,000 mitochondria per cell. Think about that. As small as a cell is, it has over 1,000 mitochondria in there. And that's just one little component. What we understand now of the way fungi talk, leaves talk, molds talk. I mean, the whole cosmos is pulsing with sentience and relational understanding and decision making. And so to come wading into this mythical, magical, life-giving complexity like a bunch of swashbuckling sailors and view it as a compartmentalized automobile that we can just take out a bearing here and a transmission here and put on a spark plug there is the height of hubris, conquistador, exploitative mentality. That's where our food system is right now. And so I think it's important to, Michael Pollan, Michael Pollan, who wrote Omnivore's Dilemma, he says that probably if you want to know what to eat, we probably shouldn't eat anything that was, that's been created, a food like substance that's been created since 1900. That's kind of 1900 is kind of the cutoff point. And of course, the joke then is that we can all be thankful that hot dogs were introduced at the 1890 World's Fair. Hot dogs just slipped right under the wire there. But I think there's a lot of truth in that. 1900, I mean, look, if you can't pronounce it, if you can't make it in your kitchen, and you can't, you can't understand it, then it probably shouldn't be eaten. And, we're the first culture in the world that ubiquitously consumes things that we can't pronounce and you can't make in your kitchen.
Absolutely agree. And I love that framing of how nature is just such a complex, beautiful beast. And this continues to come up in all sorts of different subjects I dive into, where humans are just fighting nature right now. We're trying to outsmart the world and all of its processes that are, part of what makes it so wonderful and beautiful, and everything works so perfectly and has been for so long. Yep. And we really just need to learn how to, drop the ego as a species and just revert back to the way that things are supposed to work. And this is, you know, what you're really big on, regenerative farming, which is using the new technology we have, but using it in a way that works with nature and not trying to arm wrestle with it, you know? And I think that's so important because we do have some cool stuff. We're able to, you know, do this cool video call from across the world from each other. That's awesome. You know, there's ways that we can use these technological benefits we have without completely blowing up these systems that are so important to life. And nothing's more important than the food we put in our bodies. And I think that that is, I'm very excited and optimistic about the growing movement of people that are at least asking questions about what they're eating and starting to like really think like what is actually healthy for me, because for so long, so many people have just sort of just shoveled everything in. It pops up in front of them. Just we've been sold this lie that a calorie is a calorie. Doesn't matter, mm-hmm. you know, what's actually in it. You just stuff everything in and you're getting your energy. And this is just such a huge scam from all the different food industries, the pharmaceutical industries that are all just completely profit driven. But I think this is a good time to sort of transition to the different people out there that are trying to do their best food wise. And a good example I know is the vegans. You know, pretty much all the vegans I grew up with in Seattle and know, they are really trying their best to eat what they believe is healthy and do what they believe is best and do what they think is good for the planet and the animals as well. They're not knowingly, you know, doing the exact opposite of that. And so maybe I would like to ask you this question. What do these vegans and the people who are against, you know, animal protein, maybe against like the farming that even you do, what do they have correct and what do they have wrong?
Well, wow, that's a interesting question. I think what they have right is that they care, and so I'm giving a very congratulation, you know, salute to intentionality to think about it. I mean, most Americans eat unintentionally, you know, for convenience. What's there? There's no real intentionality. And so eating intentionally is like, that's the first step in solving a problem, right? Is to realizing, oh, well, we've got a problem. And that takes observational intentionality. The problem is that, that we are not made to be vegans. Now, I want to say this very carefully. I have no problem with vegans. In fact, you know, we have a lot of customers of our customers are recovering vegans. And there is a very minor group of people who somewhat thrive under veganism. It clearly, we have genetic potential differences, you know. I mean, that's why some cultures can handle milk better than other cultures. You know, they've been centuries, you know, millennia in your background, you know, being able to handle milk. So the fact is that we, you know, we are very, very different. And so, you know, there are some people who do seem to do well on veganism, but it's very, very small, you know, less than 5% for sure. Less than 5% of the population does well. Otherwise, most people flourish better with some animal protein, you know, whether that's cheese, eggs, you know, the vegetarian approach, whether it's pescatarians who eat fish, and of course, all the way through. Now we have an increasing number of people who are, you know, the paleo, ketogenic, carnivore, you know, name what
carnivore.
You will. Yeah,
carnivore. No vegetables for over 2 years. Feeling amazing.
Wow, really? How about that? You look sick as a dog. I don't see how you can do that. And so the truth is that humans have been eating animals for a long time. So I'm gonna divide this into two thoughts. One is the philosophical thought of, well, I don't want to kill something. The truth is that nothing can live without death. I mean, one of the best examples of that is a compost pile. A compost pile is stuff that was living, that dies, that gets eaten by other things, that converts it to something that can make something else grow. So, you know, if you don't think that if you don't think that everything is eating and being eaten, go lie naked in your flower bed for, you know, 3 days to see what gets eaten. Trust me, everything is eating and being eaten. And so the very notion that we can have life without death is a fundamental ecological flaw. One of the most foundational environmental principles is that something has to die and be consumed and then resurrected in a different life form in something that eats it. I mean, that's just basic. All right. So, you know, obviously some vegans have called me a murderer, you know. Well, the fact is that we now know carrots talk to each other, tomatoes talk to each other, the mycorrhizae talk to each other, you know, the language of the microbes, you know, the Stanford professor that's figured out the language of these microbial communities. I mean, don't even start me on, no, everything is sentient and understanding, all right? Now, if you say, but you know, cows, they look, they have eyes, they look more like us. Well, then you're saying that if a being looks more like a human, it's way more valuable than a being that doesn't look like a human. And that's extremely anthropomorphistic. So let's just agree that everything consumes something else, and something has to die. That carrot has to die, the beet has to die, the tomato has to die, you know, in order for us to eat, and they're all relationally complex and communicating. Now, let's go to the nutritional aspect. So there are numerous, especially the B vitamins, that you can't get in plants. Plants just don't have it. There's a, you know, it's a relatively short list, but a very important short list of things. And so the vegan says, well, I just take supplements. Well, you know, do you really think that supplements is the way God set this up, that, you know, that we would have to, you know, take a pill in order to complement? So for me, kind of big picture, I think it's important to understand that the fact that we can actually sit around and spend time wrestling with whether or not we should eat meat is indicative not of a newly arrived, you know, evolution to some nirvana spiritual plane, but actually a profound devolution to a disconnection with our ecological umbilical. You know, our ancestors, if you could shoot it, trap it, catch it, you lived another day. They didn't have time to sit around and decide, you know, should we eat a cow or should we drink a glass of milk? They were literally in survival mode day to day to day. And the reason all ancient civilizations, the foundation of all their dietary intake was animal-based, whether it was dairy, fish, or terrestrial, or meat, the reason it was animal-based is because that was the only thing that offered nutrient density without tillage. That's why even omnivore livestock, so your chickens, turkeys, and pigs, were kind of, you know, peripheral luxuries. That was the stuff that you know, that was on the edges. The mainstay was sheep, goat, cow, camel, water buffalo, llama, alpaca. It was all herbivorous or seafood, because it was the herbivore and seafood that could be produced without growing grain, without tillage. And in the ancient, you know, societies, tillage to grow grain was really laborious. I mean, if you have to walk all day with a sharp stick behind an ox, you couldn't till up very much. And the Native Americans here, you know, we have the Three Sisters Garden, you know, the squash, beans, and corn, maize, but that was not the mainstay. That was that was a treat. You know, that was, they parched that and kept it. But the mainstay was venison and elk and bison and what they could, you know, fish that they could get out of rivers. And that was the mainstay of the diet. And all that didn't require tillage. It was hard to churn up enough ground and get the vegetation cleaned off that you could actually grow an annual. And so the whole idea of annuals is, you know, as a mainstay is completely anti-ecological. Nature tends toward perennials. Nobody's out there planting and tilling and harvesting. Nature tends toward perennials. So our food system, you know, should tend toward perennials rather than annuals. And of course, herbivores, especially cows, sheep, goats, are the things that can eat perennials. You and I can't, we can't live on grass. We can't live on chicory and goldenrod and, you know, grease grass. We can't live on that. But an animal.
Sorry to interrupt, Joel, real quick, just to make sure. Perennial just means it's like it sustains itself. It continues like planting its own seeds through its process, so we don't have to do anything, essentially, right?
Well, yeah. It survives year to year in the root mass. So in the vegetable garden, perennials would be like rhubarb, asparagus, you know, things that you don't have to plant. But annuals are like squash, watermelon, green beans, things that you have to plant every year. And yeah, thank you. So the ancient diets and ecology is foundationally a perennial ecology. And then when you realize that the American Farm Bill subsidizes only six commodities, all of which are annuals, not perennials, you realize how anti-ecological the entire American farm policy is, that it only ensures and encourages and subsidizes annuals rather than, you know, perennials, which is what nature tends toward. So the vegan thing, most people, and I've watched this over the years, you know, we've been in this a long time, and we've had so many recovering vegans come, and I say this with a broken heart, you know, that their joints, because they don't have enough collagen in what they eat to keep their joints up. Women, you know, their periods stop, they become unfertile because they don't have enough energy. You know, you get sunken eyes. I mean, we joke that you can always tell a vegan because they got sunken eyes and they got little arms. They look like Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know, with those little, you know, they just don't have this robust, flourishing appearance. And so, you know, however you want to cut this from a philosophical standpoint, there's nothing there from a philosophical standpoint. There's nothing there from an ecological standpoint, and there's certainly nothing there from a nutritional standpoint. I mean, that's why in Italy now, they outlawed vegan diets for children from like 1 to 10 or something like that. It's illegal to have your child on a vegan diet until they're like 10 years old, because the documentation, you know, your brain is fat. Your brain is fat. And if you don't get fat, I don't mean, you know, get obese. I mean, if you don't ingest a certain amount of fat, your brain simply doesn't develop. I mean, there's been some amazing studies in Africa, for example, where, you know, there's not enough animal. And what they're finding is as little as something like one egg a day increases the IQ like 20 points. I mean, it's just off the charts. So yeah, we humans, we are, you know, our eyes are in the front of our head. You know, we're made, we are hunters by, you know, by nature. And so, you know, a cow, the eyes are in the side of her head, you know, so she can see out for predators. We're the keystone predator. And so we need to exercise that role.
Yeah, beautifully said. And I've had several ex-vegans on this podcast as well, just telling their story, specifically the ones that go all the way to carnivore. And this is one of the interesting things that I've found, the patterns I've seen, is that vegans are actually closer to arriving at the carnivore diet than someone just eating the standard American diet, because they are, like you said, they're being intentional. They're trying to find the truth. And they just got they just got juked by a few Netflix documentaries to go the wrong direction. And then once, you know, enough information and personal experience is able to break through that shell that they've built, then they realize, oh, this is actually like the best way to work with nature. This is the way that nature designed me. And I'm not being evil for eating what I'm supposed to eat. You know, we shouldn't insult the lion for going to eat that antelope. That's just what nature does. And we need to be part of nature as well. And I really like that pattern of more people starting to open their minds and look at this. We have a lot of work to do, of course, but it is promising for sure. And I would throw a couple other things in there that I'm sure you will have some words on. One thing that they have right, one thing they have wrong, I think we could quickly touch on here. One of the things that they have wrong is this is good for the environment. We talked about the health part, but for the environmental part, the monocropping that is required to scale the agriculture that they have in mind. Could you give us a quick just rundown on what is monocropping? Like how this required form of like mass fruit and vegetable production is the worst thing for the environment?
Yeah, well, wow, that's a great one. And I was going to kind of interrupt and say, I want to talk about the environment with cows, even if you didn't bring it up. So you brought it up. So now I've got a nice segue to talk about, you know, cows and, you know, burping and farting cows. You know, are they going to turn us all into crispy critters in, you know, 40 years? And so I think as a starting point, I'd like to just point out that the, you know, movies like Cowspiracy, like What the Health, you know, these kinds of things.
Game Changers.
Yes, Game Changers. All of their data points and research is based on feedlots, on chemical-oriented, hormone vaccinated feedlot type production. And my point is they're not coming here to our farm to get data points. But what happens is when you go to a natural pattern, regenerative ag, whatever you want to call it, ecological farming, when you go to following nature's template in this, what happens is that all the cycles begin to close. Let me give you an example. Methanotrophic bacteria. Let me say that one more time so everybody gets it. It's a big word. Methanotrophic bacteria. Now, the first part of that is methane. Methanotrophic bacteria. All right. It is a free-living bacteria in the soil. It only lives under perennial pastures. It doesn't live under corn. It doesn't live under parking lots. It doesn't live in your yard. Okay. It lives where there is a diversified perennial pasture, and under those conditions, there's enough methanotrophic bacteria in the soil to bring down and metabolize the methane from 1,000 cows per acre. Now, nobody's going to graze 1,000 cows per acre, but that's how much wiggle room, how much protection there is in nature, in the system, to make sure that there's no waste, that everything gets completely, you know, recycled and, you know, and but these movies, these documentaries, they don't talk about that. They don't talk about anything of the positive nature. They don't talk about when people say, well, cows are inefficient. Well, yeah, they're inefficient. That's why they build soil. You know, the soils on the deepest, best soils on the planet are not under trees. They're not under bushes. They're certainly not under, you know, under crops. They're under perennial prairies. Why? Because herbivores only take a little bit of what they ingest. Most of it is recycled in manure and urine. And they actually are dumping back a lot more. I mean, here's the deal. If everything was as efficient as a squash or a green bean, we would not have any soil on the planet. So efficiency, in terms of, you know, like pounds of something per acre, is not a measure unless you look 100 years down the road and say, well, what does that acre look like after it's produced all this, you know, for 100 years? And under cropping, under annuals right now, every bushel of corn in America, every bushel of corn costs us 2 bushels of soil. It's that exploitive. And the same can be true for a lot of other things, sugar beets and all the other inputs. So when, you know, Impossible Burger, Beyond Meats, and all this, you know, vegan stuff, that people say, oh, you know, this is so much more ecological. Actually, it is way less ecological because it requires a lot of chemicals, tillage, tractor work, all this stuff, and it's a monocrop. And it sterilizes the soil rather than increasing the diversity of the soil. And so the whole thing is a fraud foisted upon people from an ecological and certainly a nutritional standpoint. But when we raise especially herbivores, cows or herbivores, in the right pattern, if you look at the way herbivores have been raised, or, you know, throughout nature, you know, right now the biggest herds are the wildebeest in the Serengeti in Africa. Those are the last, you know, remaining large herds. But, you know, if you look at the bison, the caribou, the moose, the wildebeest, the big aurochs, you know, back in prehistoric Europe, what you find is that the herbivores do three things. They move, they don't stay in the same place. They're mobbed up for predator protection. They're not scattered all out over. And then they're mowing, you know, nobody's bringing them a silage. They're not eating corn. They're mowing forages. Okay. They're pruners. So they're moving, mobbing, mowing. When you adapt all those, and utilize them on your own, you know, domestic production, just like in nature, they become the most wonderful soil building ecological asset. But if you violate any of those three M's, moving, mobbing, mowing, if you violate any of them, you turn that wonderful asset into a liability. And the truth is 95% of domestic livestock in the world violates at least one, if not two, and some all three of those natural M's. So my indictment of the documentaries that send people into a dither on this, my indictment of them is that you can't study what isn't. And I know we exist, but in the big scheme of things, in their view, we don't exist. We're too small. You know, the little, you know, regenerative ag pool of people were, you know, whatever, 2%. Okay. And so, you know, when you're going to study something, you tend to study the easy group, you know, the big group. I mean, that's where you get your statistical importance. And so when you study, when your database comes from a flawed model, then where you end up extrapolating from that is a completely flawed a conclusion if all your data points are from a flawed production, a model. And that's actually where we are. And so the beauty of this, I guess the bottom line for me is looking back that North America produced more food 500 years ago than it does today. Now, it wasn't all eaten by people. You know, we had a couple hundred million bison. We had 2 million wolves that needed 20 pounds of meat a day. That's 40 million pounds of meat just to feed wolves. Of course, we had, you know, deer, elk. We had 200 million beavers that ate more vegetables. You know, they're herbivores. We had 200 million beavers that ate more food than all the humans in North America today. We had birds. You know, Audubon sat under a tree in the early 1800s, and he recorded, he said, "I haven't seen the sun for 3 days because the flock of passenger pigeons was so tight and big. I couldn't see the, they flew over. I couldn't see the sun for 3 days." You know, has anybody seen a flock of birds go over that blocked out the sun for 3 days? I don't think so. And that's before Tyson and Purdue and Pilgrim's Pride and John Deere and all that. And so the fact is that the Native Americans actually using fire and their own hunting and their own movement, and then the predator prey relationships that we had, at that time, it was extremely productive and should give us all pause today when we realize we actually produced more food 500 years ago than we do today.
Even with all these fancy technologies and, you know, distribution methods and supply chains that we are told, I think we're sort of just subtly fed this lie that everything is working so much better now because we have all this technology, when really, when you dive into it, obviously our health is not doing better. And like you said, that the output isn't even better. So
yeah,
we really need to just completely start from scratch on this and just look at it from a blank slate. And I love how you sort of brought this into the factory farming, because when I was going earlier, when I mentioned when I was going to say one thing that I thought vegans had right, one thing they had wrong. The thing I was going to say that they have right is that factory farming is absolutely terrible. And I know that you completely agree with that as well. And I think this would be a good time to pivot over to the solution. I don't think we need to like explain too much how it's, well maybe you can, about why it's just absolutely horrible to be stuffing these animals in these tight spaces where they're just breathing their own feces and just in a horrific condition where they are being, you know, jabbed with all these vaccines and all these completely unnatural things are going on. So maybe you sort of touched on it there, but maybe you could quickly touch on, you know, why this system is terrible and really, you know, just lay that to rest, because we know that this is bad. We need to find a solution, and then we can pivot into the solution that you do so much work talking about, which is regenerative farming or regenerative agriculture and how that fixes this mess.
Yeah, sure. Well, great. So, you know, if you and I were appointed a committee, a diabolical committee, you know, think about the bad guy in James Bond movies. All right. Ha ha. You know, this conspirator. All right? And we were named on a committee to figure out how to make a pathogenic farm. We want farms that are incredibly toxic and pathogenic. All right, so we're going to sit together and we're going to conceive of a plan. Well, the first thing we want to do is we want to grow only one thing. We don't want to grow a diversified farm. We just want one thing, so the pathogens and all that, you know, they've always got a host there and they can proliferate because there's always a host there. All right. Next thing we're going to do is once we pick the one thing we're going to raise, we're going to put it as close together as possible so that the pathogens don't have to go, you know, try to find a host. That there's one right here. You know, they're all over the place. You know, we can make babies and have proliferate and, you know, and all sorts of things going on. So we would put them real close together. The next thing we would do is we would deny them fresh air. You know, there's no reason to have fresh air. Let's have them breathe in fecal particulate. You know, that would be wonderful. Fecal particulates. You know, we're gonna let them breathe in fecal particulate, and then we're not gonna let them. We're not gonna let them have sunshine. Sunshine. That's a sanitizer. We don't want sun. We're gonna put them in a building and make sure they can't have sanitary. And then. Okay, so we'll make sure they can't get much exercise. Exercise is unhealthy. Yeah, we don't want them to have exercise. Okay, so I don't mean to belabor the point, but as I've gone through this, the point is what have I just described? I've just described factory farming, and so if we wanted to, you couldn't, if you wanted to create on purpose a diabolically pathogenic farming system. You could not create, conceive, build a more effective system than factory farming. That's where we are. And of course, you know, the industry is trying to mask the health problems in that, you know, with everything from, you know, vaccines to medications, all sorts of things. And let me just say one more thing that we've learned from the chefs, all of our chefs that we supply, is that that all of our meats, our poultry and beef and pork and all this stuff, it cooks about 15 to 20% faster than store-bought, than the conventional stuff. Cooks faster. So we've been sleuthing at this for a long time. Why? And the only thing we've been able to actually come up with is that these diabolical systems are so stressful on the animal. They're immuno-stressful. They're socially stressful. They're emotionally stressful. Their habitat stressful. Okay. They're so stressful that the animal, what happens when you're under stress? You secrete adrenaline. The epitome of that is the 100-pound mom that picks the car up off her toddler. Okay. Well, what happens? Your muscles tighten up, right? That's what the adrenaline tightens up your muscles, and you're able to do this, you know, superhuman stuff and run marathons and all this stuff because you're tawny and taut and your muscles are, so it's adrenaline. All right. Which is good if you're trying to run away from a lion, you know, adrenaline was really good. I can run faster, you know, with this adrenaline. The problem is it tightens everything up. And so what we've been able to kind of deduce is that since our animals are never stressed, they're always happy, they never secrete adrenaline, and this brings them to the table relaxed and comfortable. And so I dare to ask the question, it's a little bit woo-woo, but I dare to ask the question, can we eat happiness? Or can we eat abuse? And I would suggest, you know, we say you are what you eat. Well, you know, if what we're eating lives a life of stress and abuse and disrespect, does that translate? Is there any translation there into us compared to an animal that's lived a happy, comfortable, respectful life, you know, respecting the pigness of the pig, the chickenness of the chicken. Nobody in industrial agriculture is running, to my knowledge, is running an experiment anywhere in any of our land-grant universities, which should all be defunded and shut down. The government shouldn't be, subsidizing education. That's another little side note. But nobody in any of these institutions is doing research on the benefits of happy pigs. The only question is, can we grow them faster, fatter, bigger, cheaper? That's the only question. Nobody's asking about happiness. And I would suggest that if that became the foundational question of all of our research, maybe we would start growing healthier animals, healthier food, and we would actually have happier, healthier people as a result of figuring out how to grow happier, healthier plants and animals.
Absolutely agree. And the way that Jacob Wolke put it, and he's another regenerative farmer that I talked to from Australia, how these animals that you are raising regeneratively, and we'll go into what exactly that is in a second, but they are living amazing lives. And the way that he put it was they have one bad day. You know, they have just a wonderful, fun life. And you can dive into like exactly why that is, but they're doing exactly what they want to be doing for their entire life until the very day they're harvested. And there's no stress there. You know,
right.
You couldn't ask for a better life as an animal. Like even animals that are out in the wild are having more stress and a harder time because they have to constantly worry about getting killed. And you are basically, like we said earlier, working with nature to give them like a completely natural life that they love without those stressors. So you're actually working with nature in a way that makes everything happier. So you have healthier animals, happier animals, and eventually when that natural process of life does occur, when we harvest those animals to become our food, and they're everything works perfectly. It's seamless. And so maybe we can talk, we brought this up a couple of times, like the regenerative form of agriculture. Could you give us like a regenerative agriculture 101, what exactly it is, how it's an enormous contrast from that factory farming?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things that I would just point out. One is it should be building soil, not reducing soil. I mean, that's critical. I would suggest that it should be something that's attractive to the next generation. A lot of people don't talk about that, but I think in general, a farm that's not generating a salary for two generations, I mean, that has two generations working in it, doesn't have a valid successional plan, and therefore is not sustainable. So if you're going to have a sustainable business, you've got to have that new generation capacity into it. So, you know, is it economically and emotionally and ecologically viable that a young person wants to go into it? And you know, that's a big issue. Another one is simply, how dependent is it on far-flung inputs? For example, when Putin invaded Ukraine and fertilizer jumped 400% because turns out that Russia is one of the U.S.'s largest chemical fertilizer suppliers, here on our farm, we just laughed because we don't buy any of it. You know, we were immune to that. And so we were not entangled. We were not dependent on, somewhat far-flung outfits in nefarious agenda. And so, you know, you've got soil building. I would say in general, attractiveness to the next generation, and then more on-site, on-site cycling, as opposed to, no man's an island. So there's, you're always dependent on somebody else for some things, but less is better. And perhaps the last, another one, if you want a fourth one, would be, what's it doing to the species diversity on site? We just worked with a Smithsonian study a few years ago, and, they had 29 sites in Virginia. I think we were the only ones that they found all known eight known species of bumblebees in the state, and that was kind of cool. And I think it's because there's always something pollinating here, because we have so much plant diversity, and the way we move the cows around the fields, there's always something pollinating, and so that stimulates a lot of diversity. And pollinators are a little bit of the canary in the mine. As pollinators go, so goes the ecology.
So could you walk me through, just for the total beginner, what someone will see when they actually step foot on your farm and start walking around and looking at things? So, what are the animals doing? What's the process that you take them through to mimic nature that we're talking about here?
Yeah. So the first thing you'll notice is there's no smell. That's one of the first things anybody ever says, that there's no smell, or no bad smell. I mean, yeah, there's smells, but they're good smells. Our position is, if a farm is not aromatically and aesthetically sensually romantic, it's probably not good farming. So that's the first thing, there's no smell. So when you come in, you'll notice the cattle, cows are on pasture, but they're confined to a little tiny spot. There might be 100 on 1 acre. All right. Confined with electric fence. So we move them every single day. We move them to a new paddock so that they're moving, mobbing, and mowing. And you'll notice that the grass that they're eating is long. It's not short. It's not overgrazed like you'll see coming in here, because we are resting and only allowing the cattle to get to the grass when it has regrown to what we call energy equilibrium. Then if you'll look a little bit about 3 or 4 days behind the cows, you'll see an eggmobile, and you'll see chickens spread out across the field. And the chickens are scratching through the 3 to 4 day old manure piles, manure patch, and eating the fly larva out as a pasture sanitizer behind the cows, eating out whatever parasites, grubs and things like that, eating the grasshoppers and crickets that are newly exposed because the cows just ate off the vegetation. And so the eggmobiles are portable chicken houses that the birds run in. And then you'll see over here also, maybe in the same field, you'll see broiler shelters. So these are 10 foot by 12 foot by 2 foot high, rectangular shelters, no floor. And we move them, they've got chickens in them, meat chickens, broilers, and we move them every single day, every single morning at daybreak. We move them another spot across the field, and they look like a bunch of, migrating birds in a kind of a flared V formation coming across the field. They get a fresh spot every single day. And so with our little dolly in our system, one person without starting an engine can move 4,500 of these chickens in 1 hour, and the shelters protect them from weather, from predation, and all that, and gives them a completely new salad bar, fresh air, sunshine, green material. Their bedding gets changed every day. The pigs, depending on what time of year you come, the pigs might be piggerating. So in the winter, when we run out of grass and there's snow on the ground, we have the cows under a shed awning that protects the manure and urine from winter rain and leaching. And we use a carbonaceous diaper. So another thing you'll see is a carbon shed full of wood chips. And we have a big industrial wood chipper that we work with in the woods and bring down wood chips. And the chips become a carbonaceous diaper to absorb the manure and urine from the cattle dropping in the wintertime. We add corn to it. They mix all the corn into it. The corn ferments because it's anaerobic. They're heavy, tromping out the oxygen. And you got all this fermented corn. And then the pigs, for about 2 months in the spring, the pigs are in that bedding pack, which might grow up that carbonaceous diaper. It might be 3-4 feet deep even. Put the pigs in, the pigs seek the fermented corn, and in doing so, they rotate it like a big rotavator and convert it from anaerobic to aerobic compost, with pigs paying with corn paying the pig's salary. And the pigs are great workers. They show up on time every day. They never complain. They're always happy. And I don't have to steer them anywhere. I don't have to give them a work schedule. They all know what to do. And, so it works really great. And so the pigs now build that, all that compost. When they're done, they go out into pig silvopastures. We have a bunch of these out where we put groups of 35 to 50 pigs in a group, move them every 5 to 12 days through these silvopastures. That silvopasture is like a park. It's widely spaced trees with grass underneath. And, of course, we give them feed as well, GMO-free feed. And so they get the salad bar and they get their, their cafeteria feed through. So those are just some of the things you'll see. Of course, we've got sheep. They're in electric wire too, and they're moved around every day. Turkeys, turkeys are moved around every day in a netting. We've got the Millennium Feather Net. The Millennium Feather Net is a A-frame style on skids with 1,000 layers in it, with electrified netting surrounding them. We move them, every couple of days along the pasture. So, what you'll see is there's a lot of animals. There's no smell, there's no flies, but everything is movable. It's all mobile. It's portable, moving around the pastures. And it's quite beautiful, actually.
It sounds like it, and I just want to come see it someday. I want to come check it out because I can just imagine all these contraptions moving around. It's just a beautiful sight. It all works so well. And like we said earlier, it's mimicking nature. It's really working with nature, allowing them to continue moving to different spots all the time, just like they would way back in the day, when they're just grazing and sort of moving across the land. And I think that's so cool. Where can someone go to like learn about those parts specifically? Like, I don't know if those contraptions are, you know, things that other people could like make themselves, or are these
Absolutely. We have a big, heavy, thick book. It weighs 5 pounds, and it's the blueprints. It's the building designs. It's called Polyface Designs. Polyface Designs, and it has all this mobile infrastructure in it. You can get that. And if you don't want to read it, it's 5 pounds, so you can use it for weightlifting if you don't want to read it. But it's a you know, big, thick, heavy book. All this stuff is detailed in there, you know, and a lot of people, you know, they always ask me, well, yeah, this is really creative. You know, how'd you come up with this? Well, you come up with it when you study nature and you have very simple phrases. Like, for example, in nature, animals move. I mean, that's such a simple phrase. Animals move. They're not stationary. They're not pinned up. They move. Well, as soon as you say, okay, so animals move. All right. As soon as you say that phrase, well, now you need to control them somehow. You need to get them water somehow. You need to get them feed. You need to get them shelter. And so that simple phrase, animals move, you know, springboards you into all this other stuff. So it's not like we sat around here one day in a yoga focus group position saying, you know, how can we be weird or how can we be innovative? It's actually just we sat around and said, well, how does nature work? Well, animals move. All right. And then how do we handle that? How does soil get built? It doesn't get built with 10-10-10 chemical fertilizer. Oh, it gets built with carbon. So how do we increase carbon? So now we're composting the carbonaceous diaper, perennials, movement, you know. And so they're really very, very simple questions with profound ramifications when you start looking at nature as template rather than nature as something to be either adulterated, disrespected, or, or abused.
Absolutely. Yep. And Joel, I know you have a very busy schedule. We got about 15 minutes left here. So I think this would be an excellent time for one last question for people, which I would say probably the majority out there who are hearing this and thinking, this sounds so cool. I want to participate. I want to become part of this, but I don't have a farm, or, you know, I don't have the time to like, you know, build all these contraptions or really like do the deep dive into the large scale regenerative agriculture. I know that you are also a very big proponent of people taking important steps on a micro level. And I can use my parents as an example here. My mom and dad are actually building a new property, and they are going to have a garden. They're going to have some space, some grass, some trees. And I would love for you to just give your sort of 101 on what people can start doing now. I know one of the things you always talk about is everyone should have chickens. So maybe that could be sort of the kickoff. But what do you think the people out there who have just a little bit of land and want to get their feet wet should do? What's their starter guide?
Yeah, so I've got, that's a really good question. I've got a kind of a three ingredient recipe as an answer to that question. So I got three things. Number one, get in your kitchen. We cannot have an authentic food system until we rediscover domestic culinary arts. And I'm not talking about grandma's kitchen, you know, having to go to a spring with a wooden bucket to fetch water. I mean, when you think about our modern kitchens, we've got every techno glitzy sophisticated thing. We've got Instapots, bread makers, ice cream makers, you know, KitchenAid, hot and cold running water, refrigerators. I mean, hot crock pots, good grief. You know, we've got everything today. So cooking from scratch has never been easier. It's never been easier. And so we need to leverage that. We can't abdicate food participation as profoundly as we have and expect integrity provenance. You can't. You have to feel the chicken. You gotta get in there. Get in there and do it. So number one, get in your kitchen. Number two, do something yourself, even if it's just a quart jar of sprouted mung beans on the windowsill, or a little worm vermicomposting kit, you know, under the kitchen sink. or a hanging little herbal, PVC patio garden. In my book, Polyface Micro, I have how to have rabbits and chickens in a Manhattan apartment on a footprint that's no bigger than a Lazy Boy recliner. Okay. Yeah, chickens are definitely my animal of choice on small spaces because they can take your kitchen scraps and turn them into eggs. They're also a great teenagers, role model for teenagers. Chickens are the first animals up in the morning. They wake up as soon as it's light and they spend all day turning trash into treasure. And as soon as the sun starts to go down, they go up and they go to bed. I mean, that's a great role model for teenagers, up happy in the morning, working all day happily, and then go to bed as soon as it gets dark. So do something yourself just to participate in the mystery, the majesty of life. And number three then is to connect to your own provenance. You can turn off your Netflix and take a little bit of invest some time and energy in connecting to your provenance, whether it's on a website, whether it's going out and visiting some farms, going to farmers market, whatever, but connect to some provenance. And if I may make a shameless ad here, if you're completely stymied and you don't know where to start, you can start by placing an order with us. We ship nationwide every week. And if if this sounds too good to be true, let us send you some food and you'll quickly find out. But do something to connect to your provenance. Don't just let yourself be part of that opaque food system. Well, I don't know where this came from. I don't know who this is. I don't know anything about this. Connect to your provenance and get something with a label that you can read every single thing on the label, know what it is and pronounce it. So that's my recipe, Ben. Get in your kitchen, do something yourself and connect to your provenance.
Fantastic. And I will make sure to leave the links to your entire book collection. You said you have 16 books. Is that right?
Yes. That's right.
Amazing. And that is, I'm such a big fan of people who put their work and their heart and soul into writing because that's such a permanent fixture people can have in their home. They can go out and sit in the grass, sit in the garden, start visualizing these things as they're reading your book and really putting it all together. So really recommend people check those out and start digging through your work to get caught up. And man, there's so much other stuff I want to talk about, but I know that you have a very busy schedule, which I love to see. You're doing amazing work out there, sir. So thank you so much for joining me today, Joel Salatin. I appreciate you very much for everything that you're doing and for taking the time to talk with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
The delight's been all mine, Ben. Yeah, thank you.